The Science Inside Podcast. This is The Science Inside with Elna.
Welcome to the show. My name is indeed Elna Schütz, and this is the 1 week, the 1 hour in the week, rather, where we get a little bit nerdy on the Science Inside. It's a show where we look at all kinds of science that relates to your lives, to what's happening in the world, and we really just try to make it something that's really palpable and applicable to our ordinary lives. We're not just talking about lab coats and doctors far away. We really want to bring it close to home. And today we are talking about something that is quite serious and may possibly happen to you at some time. So I think it's very important that we do just spend a little bit of time speaking about this. It is indeed National Burns Awareness Week, as well as Burns Awareness Month this May. So we wanted to look at burn injuries. And you might say, oh no, I'm careful, I don't get burned. But you never know. These things can happen very easily, accidentally, and even though we're obviously not hoping that this happens to any of us, if it does, I want to make sure that you as our listener are at least a little bit prepared, know what to do, know what your options are, or just to be more aware of this in general, because every single year in South Africa, over 1.6 million people get burn injuries. And of those, over 10%, so around 12%, are fatalities. So it's also an incredibly common cause of burn injuries for children under 4 years old. And of course, that is one of the main concerns that people have, that a child might get burned. Of these burns, the most common group is still hot water burns, of course, in the kitchen or something like that. What did surprise me, however, is that among these burns, there's quite a big group that is classified as assault. So people are actually using water as a weapon in a way against someone, or maybe in an argument or so on. But of course, there are also many, many accidental burns. You might be wondering about chemical and electrical burns, and these do happen, but they are far more rare. That's just to give you a little bit of the lay of the land when it comes to these things. And as I said, we all hope that it never happens to us, but let's be prepared. Let's think about this for a second. If you get burned, what do you do? Because I think a lot of us have heard things over the years. I've heard everything from put butter on it to put Vaseline on it to, I don't know, just ignore it, it'll go away. And I just want to bring some science into these ideas. You may not know this, but a burn doesn't just end when you take away the source of the burn. So maybe the hot water or a stove or whatever it might be. It actually carries on to a certain degree. If you think, for instance, of a stove top or an oven, when you switch it off, there's still a lot of heat there that first has to sort of go away. And that, in a way, is what happens to your skin. So the best thing you can actually do, first and foremost, is try stop the burn. So obviously remove the source, but that heat needs to be counteracted even on or within your skin. So what doctors actually recommend is using cold water for around 20 minutes. So that sounds like a long time, I know, but putting your hand or whatever part of your body it might be under cold running water for around 20 minutes just helps that skin calm down and the burn to stop carrying on. And yes, just cold water, nothing else. Do not use ice. Do not use ice water. And that was quite shocking to me, because I think a lot of people, when they get burnt, go straight to the freezer. Those, you know, that tub of ice cream, although maybe you just want to eat some of that. But those frozen peas, whatever it might be, you think the colder the better. But actually, because your skin is already damaged and quite sensitive, ice water can actually cause a frostbite. So you don't want to do that. You also don't want to use any other kind of product like toothpaste or butter. You don't want to seal the burn in any way. So those are some of the very practical things you can do at home if you do get burned. And then, of course, you want to get medical attention if it is quite severe. And if it is an open wound, you want to maybe just cover it with something like cling film. Those are the very basics, and now that we know them, we'll go into some of the more medical procedures around more severe burns later in the show today, since, as I said earlier, it is Burn Awareness Week in South Africa this week. But on the show also, we do look at some other things. In our Unscience, we talk about a spider that's acting all bent in when it comes to its mating preferences. It's a very strange story. Later then, our scientist behind the science is Dr. Surakha Muniasamy, who is trying to develop a plastic that's biodegradable. I'm very excited for that conversation. But before all of that, we get into our news, of course, and we want to hear from you also. Let us know, did you know that it was Burns Awareness Week? Did you maybe have somebody in your family, even yourself, who's got burned? And most importantly, I'd love to hear from you. Did these tips maybe bust any myths? Did you always think you use butter or bicarbonate of soda? Tell me all of that on Facebook. Please note that we are no longer the Science Inside on Facebook. We are now to be found under Vow FM. So that is a place you want to go. You want to use hashtag Science Inside, which is also the hashtag you'll be using on Twitter for @VowFM. You can WhatsApp your stories on 084-078-4912. And the podcast will be up on wits.journalism.co.za/science. You can find all those details online if you're driving or don't have anywhere to write it down. Just look for the Science Inside. But first up, let's get into the thick of things with the news.
This week's Science Headline.
I have with me here once again, Lebo, one of our producers. Hi, Lebo.
Hello, Alna. My news story today is from ENCA.com, AcadianAddiction.com, Telegraph.co.uk.
Okay.
So, Nigeria bans cough syrups over fears of addiction is the headline from ENCA Africa.
Okay.
Now, you probably know that cough syrups often contain codeine, right? Mm-hmm. They've recently been banned in Abuja, Nigeria, because the government fears that they could be possible causes of misuse and addiction. This was recommended by a working committee that was set up in January to look at the misuse of prescription drugs. The ban also applies to the sales of unprescribed codeine-containing cough syrups across the whole country. Now, the Minister of Health in Nigeria, Isaac Adewole, suggests that codeine-containing cough syrups should be replaced with dextromethorphan, which is less addictive. This now leads us to the question about whether the whole world should follow Nigeria's example to fight the effects of codeine addiction, which include poverty and unemployment.
Okay, so I know that South Africa has tried to put some measures in place. If you buy certain products with codeine in it, you have to actually tell your pharmacist. But we have covered this on the Science Inside, and I've got to say personally, I wasn't convinced that the measures South Africa put in place are really going to stop someone who has an addiction and is trying very hard to get this kind of stuff. So even though there are people who might be looking for this, it's very serious if a country is wanting to ban it. That's quite a clear signal. But tell us a little bit more about how codeine can become an addiction.
Okay. So we know cough syrups, we take them to treat our colds or relieving our pains. And codeine-laced cough syrups can calm or give you a sense of pleasure, right? That feel-good state happens when the codeine enters your brain and causes neurotransmitters that stimulate the reward center in your brain to be released.
Okay, that makes sense. But I'm sure that a lot of us listening are thinking, sure, I'm sure that happens to some people, but I'm not planning on like downing cough syrup like a cocktail anytime soon, even if it is purple and tastes delicious, at least some of them. So does this mean that if I'm choosing a cough syrup or I'm prescribed a cough syrup that has codeine, I'm automatically making it more likely that I'll become an addict?
Yes. Yes, that is the case. Like with other addictive pain relievers, when you drink this cough syrup over a long period of time, you eventually develop a tolerance, right? And you may start to take it a little bit more, And before you know it, you may start to experience withdrawal when you go without it for a period of time. And then this starts a cycle that develops into an addiction.
Okay, I think the other thing there for me is that if I have a cough that is persisting so long that I'm using the same cough syrup over and over again for weeks on end, I feel like I should also be asking myself why my cough isn't going away. Maybe go back to the doctor. But Lebo, how do I know that I've moved now from just using my medication as I should to something that could resemble addiction?
Okay, so codeine addictions commonly cause chronic headaches, which cause people to want to take more to help them heal their headache. So at the end, you start taking it a lot more and becomes an addiction.
Okay, that makes sense. You did mention some of the effects earlier, but tell us more about what this can actually do to someone.
Okay, so these are just a few effects. There's a lot more. So it can cause domestic problems, major depression, liver damage, kidney failure, a loss of productivity, and it can put someone in a coma. Yeah, those are the results of being addicted to codeine.
Okay, I think a lot of those things are obviously true of many, many addictions, regardless of what you're addicted to. It can have quite big socioeconomic effects on you as well as health effects. But I can understand that something like cough syrup, you might get an addiction to it without completely understanding that that's happening, because you're not looking for this on some sneaky back alley.
Exactly, it's right there.
Yeah, and you probably were prescribed the cough syrup for some good reason, but still, I think I will try to rather use herbal things, drink my little lemon and ginger tea where I can.
Yes, or you could stay warm throughout the winter and get a flu shot.
Yes, big fan of flu shots, which are obviously quite important at this time of year in general. So Libo, I have a story for you. Comes from Science Daily, the University of Ulm in Germany, and the University of Colorado Boulder. And I have to ask you, do you think it's important for kids to grow up with animals and nature and all these nice things around them?
Yes, definitely, but as long as the animals don't bite.
Okay, that's a pretty fair answer. I think I would also definitely say yes, but maybe that's just because I think it's great to be around animals and have pets and stuff.
Yes.
But it's not just a preference thing, because actually new research is showing that what kind of environment you grow up in as a child may have an effect on your mental health. So this study indicates that being in a rural environment with pets may be better for you in the long run, and you may be surprised by the reasons for why this is better than living in a city as a child.
So is it because you get lots of fresh air and you get to run around a lot more than the city kids?
Yeah, now we kind of sound like old tunnies who are like, in my day. But actually, I'm sure that's pretty good for you. But this particular piece of research is saying it's not because of that, it's because of the dust. So other kinds of research have shown that being around furry friends and some kinds of allergens and dust does later in life mean that you are less likely to get asthma and allergies. And this kind of research does add to a growing set of ideas that overly sterile, clean, perfect places are actually not that great for kids. They can cause health problems. This particular study I was talking about, though, doesn't just focus on the health problems. They are focusing on mental health problems. And the way they did that was they stressed out participants, and I found it quite funny how they decided to do this. They gave them very difficult math problems.
Wow.
And made them give speeches to a big audience.
Wow. That sounds so stressful, though.
I really like math problems, so that would have failed on me. But I'm sure for a lot of people that would have been pretty bad. So afterwards and during, they checked the blood and saliva of the participants for levels of a certain immune system component. This is what they found. The city kids had much higher levels after the stressful event. So they did have more of this stressful sort of immune system component. But, funnily enough, they reported feeling less stressed than their counterparts, which in this case was adults that had grown up in the country. So it's like this very stressful response is there in the city kids very strongly, but it's almost not being noticed by them. They're so used to it.
Okay, so how does this affect your mental health?
Yeah, because as I said, the physical side is understandable, but what about the mental side? So basically, having these high inflammatory responses has been linked to later in life being more likely to develop depression, post-traumatic stress disorder, and other things. So the authors are saying that there are chances that on top of allergies and asthma, psychiatric disorders may also be caused by these factors, namely not being around animals and not being around a lot of dust. So I do have to say, reading the study, I know it's very intriguing, and I think there's definitely something here, but I am a little bit skeptical, Lebo, because these results were only done on 40 German men between the ages of 20 and 40, of which half were kids on farms and the other half had lived in large cities without pets when they were small. So first of all, it's quite a small sample. And I'm also wondering, why did they only ask men? Was there a reason for that? Do men's bodies react differently to stress? Where did that come from? And also, I do understand why they made it such a binary sort of condition, some being completely without pets in a city and some being completely on a farm. But I feel like many children are somewhere in between. Like many children are technically in cities but are surrounded by dust and pets, while some kids on farms may not really interact with these things at all and be inside playing video games all day.
Exactly.
So the study, I think, starts something, but doesn't completely convince me.
I get your point. There definitely needs to be a bigger study done on this.
Yeah, that's a little bit more, just comprehensive.
This is very narrow. It's also in like one region in Germany. That's it.
Yeah, just German men. So yes. If you are listening and you're a German man, this may apply to you particularly. Who knows? Especially because these things are important, though, because over half the world's population lives in cities. And so I think the moral of the story here is just go play outside. I don't care what age you are. Just go play.
Yeah.
Okay. So that was our Science Inside news. And next up, in light of Burns Awareness Month this May, we are looking at how plastic surgeons help burn victims in South Africa.
Stay curious. Stay informed. Stay on the Science Inside.
Welcome to the show. My name is Alna Schutz. Remember, you can find us anywhere on social media with the hashtag Science Inside. This month is Burns Awareness Month in South Africa, and earlier you would have heard that over 1.5 million people get burn injuries every single year. It breaks my heart. I have so many faces in front of me of people that I've known who have gotten burnt and or have met over the years. And I think this is really not just an issue. It's something that affects individuals. It affects their families, the way they see themselves, the way they decide to live their lives with courage. And it is quite a serious medical issue that we want to look at. We want to give it some airtime in light of Burns Awareness Month. But as I was saying, it's not just statistics. It's not just an issue. It is people. So what better way to start this story than with a person? Here is an individual called Rulani Mabasa, and this is his story.
So what happened is that I was studying for a chemistry test. I felt too tired, then I fell asleep. Falling asleep, I left the heater on, and there was a ceremony at home, umsebenzi ngesiZulu. So ikhasi, which is the gas, was next to the heater, all right? So I fell asleep, left the heater on, and an explosion occurred. I was woken up by the smoke because it was choking me. I woke up, I was like, happening. Then I ran the opposite direction, hit the wall, passed out for around about 3 minutes. When I woke up, I tried getting out, but the door was on fire. So I had to jump out of the window. Luckily, there were no bites. After jumping out, I just laid there on the ground, and it was so cool. Like, the night was so cold. So I actually feel cool because it was hot inside and all that. Mom came out rushing, crying and screaming and all that stuff. And yeah, the entire family was woken up. I don't know what woke them up. I think it was the window. I was rushed to hospital. Last thing I remember was me screamed. And I passed out because they gave me morphine. And I woke up at least after 3 to 4 days. So what happened is that they haven't, at that time, they haven't done any operation. They just scraped out the burnt skin. And yeah, I was all white, actually. No, I was a white guy for quite some time. Hey, so what happened is that they screamed me out. I couldn't see for about 2 weeks. I think it was 2 weeks. After then, they had to do, all my burns were on the face. It was second degree, hands was third degree, back was third degree, right? Because what burnt me wasn't the fire per se, but it was the steam around. It was that hot that it melted my skin out and was dangling out there. Proceeding with my story, so after 2 weeks they did skin graft, which is they took skin from my thighs. Pieces of skin, like a lot. I think they took an excessive amount of skin from my thighs, but it's fine. So after taking my skin, they obviously put it on my arms for a while and all that stuff. My thighs were so sore. Scars. I think I'm gonna be keeping them. No, I'm not thinking. I know I'm gonna be keeping them, because I mean, like, I like them the way they are, and they actually, I see them as a map of my journey to success. That Ru has been through this and that, but then I'm actually prospering and actually keep striving for the best, and I know I'll make it, and hopefully I'll get to inspire people wherever they are and however, and be an icon for those who thought their physical disabilities or whatever physical change they had to go through. So hopefully I'll make a change and restore some other people's self-esteem and confidence and stuff. Yeah, so that's me.
I love how Rilani is able to sort of see the best in what happened to him and see his scars with courage and confidence. I don't think that all burn victims are necessarily able to get to that point easily. And he was telling us about how he had to get a skin graft. Many people get skin grafts, but also other kinds of plastic surgery or reconstructive surgeries, whether this is a choice or whether they have to medically go under the knife. And we wanted to understand this medical route a little bit better. So we spoke to Dr. Wayne Klankies, a plastic and reconstructive surgeon in Cape Town. And before we get into some of the procedures, he just wanted to explain in general what plastic surgery really is.
The word plastic is derived from the Greek word plastikos, which means to change. So plastic surgery is about changing shapes on the body, and basically reconstructive surgery. So one of the spectrums of changing shapes would be cosmetic surgery. So those are the two broad categories of what we do. Is we do operations for cosmetic purposes, where we change shapes or forms of the body, and the other one would be for reconstructive purposes. Reconstructive purposes would be from injuries or cancers or other congenital or acquired deformities.
He was talking about those two things, cosmetic plastic surgery and then reconstructive. And I think a lot of us, to be honest with you, when we see a sign for plastic surgeon and we think about it, we might just be thinking about boobs and butts and that kind of cosmetic surgery. But the truth is, of course, that these doctors do a lot of very complicated, impressive medical work like reconstructions and helping burn patients that is most definitely not a cosmetic choice. Here are some of the most common procedures when it comes to treating burn injuries.
For burn victims, what usually happens with the serious burns where you have deep tissue injuries is that one must cut away the dead tissue, almost like a cancer. We can't leave the dead tissue on the body, otherwise the patient gets infections and they can die from the infections. So once we get the dead tissue off, then we must cover the open wounds with preferably skin. Now, skin from the patient's own body is called an autograft, and that's what you usually try and do. But when the burn wounds get bigger, and usually when it's more than 40% of the total body surface area, there's not enough skin on the body of the patient to cover it in one go or two goes. So in those cases, then we'll do serial operations, or like cover, you know, a percentage in one go and then do another percentage at another go. But then also with the wounds, when we've cut off dead tissue and it's large wounds, then we need to cover it with something similar to skin. And if a patient doesn't have enough skin, then sometimes we use skin from another person. And that we call allograft skin.
So the growing or cloning procedure works in a very specific way, and there is both an original technique and now this newer, improved one developed by Dr. Klankies. So just to understand that better, here he is explaining it.
The growing procedure, the one that was originally described and still used by the Boston lab, was from 1972-1973. What they do is they grow the skin, but they grow it on mouse fibroblasts or mouse cells from a mouse. So that DNA of the mouse is then incorporated into that construct with the patient cells that are being grown. And they're actually classified as a xenograft because of the mouse cells that is being used with the patient's own cells. The technique that I developed at Tyburg Hospital in 2014, we grow the skin, but without using any animal material. So we just use the patient's own skin, and the matrix that we use is a dressing, a wound dressing called sawback. It's got no animal tissue in per se to cause allergic responses, and therefore the transplant can be classified just as an autograft. The success of that, it gives a similar survival for severe burns. It gives a 90% survival. But the graft take that we found here was that it was better. We got almost 80% graft take in all our patients, which is better than the 72.9% of the other technique, the standard technique in America.
I'm always so excited to hear when South African doctors or scientists are making things better and improving those statistics and finding procedures that are going to help more people in better ways. That's always very exciting to hear. And even though these procedures are incredibly needed and aren't a choice and can even be the difference between, you know, somebody being severely scarred or whatever it might be, there is another thing, and that is, of course, the costs. These kind of procedures can be incredibly costly. You heard they have to grow your skin. So we wanted to ask him a bit about that.
In the private sector, plastic surgery is expensive. I think anyone that wants to undergo like a major plastic surgery procedure could expect to pay, you know, a significant amount of money. In the state sector, the availability of services are usually dependent on whether there's a plastic surgery department or a plastic surgeon at the hospital. And usually then also it will be dependent on the resources made available to the plastic surgery department. For example, if there's a laser, then that can be used for scar management. But if there isn't, then obviously you can't use it. So that would vary according to different hospitals and provinces, depending on availability and resources.
Beyond just the monetary costs and what you're putting down in cash, there is, of course, a very big question when these things happen, when there are big medical procedures to be done and surgeries to be done, which is, what are the risks? Are there risks for getting infections or for something terrible happening? So we asked the doctor about that.
With any operation, there are many side effects, and the same is with plastic surgery. So these side effects, one must discuss with the patient, and then one must assess the patient and decide what are the risk factors for this specific patient, because every patient is different. You have patients with very high risk factors for complications due to either smoking or other diseases, and then one could advise them not to have surgery. But then you get patients with like very low risk factors for surgery or no risk factors for surgery, and the chance of them getting a complication would be very minimal or unexpected. And those are the patients that you can advise, yes, it's safe to do surgery. The risk of these complications are low and should be easily manageable. And I think that's the way to do it for every patient. You have to individualize it.
That's the truth with these things, that there are risks and really does depend on your individual case. There's no doctor in the world that will be able to tell you there is a zero risk. That is unfortunately just the reality of it. But it is still so amazing that there's plastic surgery and skin grafts and doctors that can help you if the worst happens and you do get injured by some kind of burn. And I also want to just remind you that South Africa does have a skin bank, which is kind of like being an organ donor, except it's for your skin, and your skin actually, if you do pass on, parts of it can be used to help people with severe injuries. Just cover up the wound. They have a procedure to do this, and until their own skin grows back, to put it in very simple terms. So if you are already an organ donor or you've considered it, I would highly recommend that you also look at tissue donation, because you can, through the South African Skin Bank, help so many people and make their lives better in quite difficult circumstances. That was a story for Burns Awareness Week and Burns Awareness Month. This May, I do encourage you to think about your houses and how you use hot liquids and things like that, and just make sure that you are prepared and ready just in case. You are still on The Science Insider. Next up, it gets a little bit lighter, a little bit weirder with our And Science.
You're listening to The Science Inside, bringing you science around major news events.
If you're a regular listener on The Science Inside, you know exactly what time it is now. It is Science time, which is exactly what it sounds like. It is science that makes you go, no, surely not. That's a little bit weird. This package today is about quite a curious case. Let's get into it.
Okay.
Unusual, unlikely, unscience.
So today I have our producer Lebo with me again. I hear me and Mr. Jones in the background. What is happening?
Okay, get this, Alna. Brown male widow spiders literally die for love. When it comes to matters of the heart, for male brown widow spiders, they tend to fancy older and more experienced female mates. Sometimes they risk their chances of escaping alive. Should a male choose an adult female, he stands a 50% chance of being eaten after sex. However, if he mates with a younger female spider, he might just be in luck and live to see the light of day.
No, Lebo, what are you bringing me here? This sounds ridiculous. Are you really telling me that spiders have Ben 10 tendencies? It sounds a little bit weird. Obviously, spiders don't necessarily have romantic emotions like we do. We are making fun of it just a little bit. But let's get into the science a little bit more. What exactly deters these younger female spiders from eating their mates?
Okay, according to Professor Ali Harari at the Agricultural Research Organization in Tel Aviv, he says male widow spiders would rather risk their lives than copulate with younger female spiders. This is despite the fact that younger female spiders are actually more fertile, healthier, and less violent. When they do mate with a younger mate, mating is very short, hence there's a high rate of survival.
Okay, that is quite bizarre though, considering that many of us in general are bird, you know, we think that younger is better, you know, that younger animals would be stronger and just, you know, just generally better, right?
Wrong. Scientists can't explain why this behavior occurs exactly. They think that older females may be emitting enticing pheromones that trick males into thinking that they are far more fertile than they actually really are.
Ah.
The consequences of this deception then results in a fooled young male to engage in this dubious mating pattern. It is thought that that older females are more desperate to mate. Thus, they exert more effort into advertising their availability.
That's ridiculous. Wow.
I'm sure you're aware that widow spiders derive their popular name from their cannibalistic nature. Female brown or black widow spiders are renowned for eating their male partner after mating. Some of these species do take measures to avoid being eaten. Female brown widow spiders tend to be larger as well, and then they are able to consume their male counterparts easier because they're much larger.
Okay, so there's not as much patriarchy, at least amongst spiders. So you still have to explain one thing to me, though. How are they eating, like, how are they eating their, like, the male spiders? How's that happening?
Okay, so apparently during copulation, males often somersault. They somersault during their mating time.
Okay, we'll just take that as a fact.
Yes. It is in this somersaulting that males end up jumping into the female's mouth.
What?
Yep. And it's not understood why males actually somersault, but their mating sessions need to be long to enable their desirable amount of sperm to fertilize the female spider. As you can imagine, the longer the sex session, the higher the likelihood of being eaten.
Okay. I cannot believe we are talking about the sex lives of spiders in such detail. So it really does sound almost like toxic love. How exactly did these researchers discover all of this?
The research team introduced the virgin males to adolescent and adult female spiders. What they discovered about half of the males that had mated with adolescent females is that they were actually eaten. And then all the other males that had mated with much older, more experienced female spiders had a much larger chance of being cannibalized.
Okay, that makes sense. So do explain it a little bit more, though.
It seems they like them a little bit older. Male brown widow spiders always gravitate towards the older female spiders, and the mating lasts longer because they find them more enduring. Researchers found that males hardly spent any time pursuing adolescent females. I think this is the behavior that can be linked to women finding more tough guys a little bit more attractive and all.
No, I'm not buying that. Surely not. I don't think we should be looking at spiders and guessing that about humans. But I get your point. So are the males able to successfully fertilize the females since they are risking their lives to keep the species alive, basically?
Yes, they actually are. But not without obviously meeting their fatal fate, of course. Over time, male spiders have developed a gruesome tactic, a couple of these gruesome tactics to successfully fertilize their female counterpart. One of the methods used to avoid being eaten is to orally lubricate females' genitals to prolong courtship. Sorry.
Nope, did not want to know that.
I mean, you can take a couple of tips here.
Nope.
In some instances, to ensure reproductive success, they are known to guard the female after mating. Given the opportunity, they may also block the reproductive opening of the female with a mating plug or chemically manipulate the female's sexual appeal. This lessens the likelihood of her actually mating with other males.
No, I know this is biology, but still, it just sounds too creepy to me. It's like the Sex Files of brown male widow spiders or something.
More like 50 Shades of Grey Spider Edition. But I'm not done yet.
Oh, no.
The study also reveals an unusual trend in these species. During the somersaulting that happens, that I mentioned earlier, the male boosts his jump by pushing against the female's abdomen area, and whilst tumbling in mid-air, he mistakenly lands in the mouth of the much larger female, leading to his ultimate death.
Wow, that was really one of the most bizarre insights I've heard in a while. The story was found on the Daily Mail website, and today's Unscience was produced by Bridget LePere. A big thank you goes to Improbable Research, which is a great place to find more cool science like this. But as I said, today's story was from Daily Mail. Next up, we speak to our scientist behind the science.
Unusual, unlikely, unscience. You're listening to The Science Inside, bringing you science around major news events.
Hello and welcome back to the show. As I said earlier, The Science Inside, you can find us on Twitter and Facebook. Just use the hashtag Science Inside. And we are also to be found as Vow FM. We now go to a little interview we like to call The Scientist Behind the Science, because I know that it's easy to think of science as this thing far away and out of maybe your comfort zone. But the truth is that not only is a lot of science something that ends up as products or inventions that help us greatly, of course, scientists are also people. So we like to talk to them and sort of just to pick their brain a little bit about why they do what they do. And today we're speaking to Dr. Surakar Muniasamy. He is from the Council for Scientific and Industrial Research, specifically in the Department of Polymers and Composites. And they are trying to make strides in developing technology of bioplastics, which will contribute to the reduction of environmental pollution and also boost local job creation. So basically, they are hoping to make biodegradable plastic technology, which just blows my mind if you think about it. Can you imagine plastics that biodegrade, and we don't have to worry about this growing problem? I'm very excited to speak to the brain behind this development and the production of 100% degradable plastic bags that is hopefully happening soon. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
So maybe let's just start with you and how you started on this journey of looking for alternatives to the sort of plastic bags we are very familiar with.
We know that the plastic pollution is all over the world, that we are having, the plastic pollution problem, that it takes many decades to degrade. So normally the plastic bag, when you end up the landfill or marine water, it takes 200 years to 400 years to degrade.
Yes.
So it causes a severe environmental pollution to the marine and aquatic habitat. So as you all know that. So actually, my research is motivated from, the research was started in 2007. So from my, after my education, master's degree completed. So I'm very serious on this research. So I want to do more on this, develop environmentally friendly materials. So I started my research, then I spent 5 years in Italy to do my PhD, so on the development of biodegradable plastic. Then after that, I went to Canada to learn about how the manufacturing certification and how to claim the products and everything to learn. So after that, I got opportunity to CSIR, South Africa, to do this research on the, utilizing the local agriculture biomass to develop a biodegradable plastic product.
Okay, so even though you are working on a biodegradable plastic bag, I understand that the aim behind the project is not to completely get rid of the production of plastic products, which a lot of people may be asking for. Why is that exactly?
If you look at the single-use plastic items, if you look at the whole plastic production, mainly 50 to 60% is mainly going for the packaging application. So the making, mainly the thin film items, carrier bags, food wrapping bags, which is not biodegradable. So even the recycling also is very, very limited. So the idea is to stop the plastic pollution. We need to stop which is not recyclable items. It should be biodegradable. So that is the reason our research is very focused. And we want to utilize that material which comes from the plant source. So that is one to be environment friendly, like starch and cellulose and other biopolymers, so which are naturally available materials that we can make the carrier pack. We can improve the pack similar like a normal polypropylene bag. But after end of uses, if you dispose to the landfill or any marine environment or compost condition, so the material is completely disappear. That is the invention we have developed with the CSIR group.
And it does sound like, in one way, a really good solution, because we know that even though so many people are aware that plastic is not biodegradable, they aren't changing their habits. It is just continuing. So perhaps being able to supplement those habits with something that is better for the environment is a good move. Although I'm sure a lot of people who are very environmentally aware would not agree with me on that one. But do tell me a bit more of what kind of impact this invention would have for South Africa, but also the world.
If you look at the Africa, there is no biodegradable plastic technologies available currently. So currently, we are currently using the petroleum-based plastics, which are non-biodegradable. So that is the main. So if you look at the globally, there are a lot of R&D research is mainly focused, mainly in Italy, Canada and other countries in Australia, there are already, and Germany as well, they are already developing some compostable plastics. They are already developing it. It is still in the beginning stage, so still they are working in it. So the similar way, we want to develop that similar concept. At South Africa, we want to utilize locally available sources like agriculture brand like sugarcane papa. We may utilize the raw material from sugarcane material and also from the main stocks, byproducts. So we can utilize the raw material and that we can develop the bioplastics technology. That's we are currently working on it.
And just to clarify, how close is this product to being on the shelves? Or rather, not on the shelves, I guess it would be handed out at tills.
For us to get the products on the shelves, currently we're busy liaising with government entities to put it on a pilot scale production. And once we put it on a pilot scale production, then within a year or two, we'll be able to see its for market trials on the shelf to see how consumers would buy into it.
Right.
My name is Ose Oposu, and I work in collaboration jointly with Dr. Sudhakar Munyasami.
And just to end it off, we always ask our experts this. What is the one thing that you wish people knew about your area of work? If you could clarify something or just talk to the listeners out there, what do you wish people knew about biodegradable plastics or plastics in general?
As it has been mentioned earlier by Dr. Sami, plastics, as we know it in general, do not biodegrade. And this new invention we've made is such that we getting it from agro residues, that is low-cost agro residues. So if people could know that we can extract high-value products or chemicals from agro residues, then I think it will improve on our agricultural processes and then add a bit more value to our farmers and the farm workers in terms of things like maize stalks that are bent on the field for us to extract some chemicals out of it to put it into developing this biodegradable plastic bag.
And I really hope that you do succeed and that it's going to really make a difference to not just the ordinary lives of South Africans, but all of that plastic that's currently sitting in landfills. I really hope that the generations that come after us think about that as almost a laughable idea, because we have changed our habits for good. Thank you so much for joining us on the Science Inside.
Thank you.
That was our scientist behind the science. Do stay listening.
You don't have to be a liker to like things.
Oh my God.
So like us on Facebook.
Like us on Facebook.
At Paul Van, in brackets, Voice of Bits.
We have come to the end of the Science Inside for today. And as always, we now transition from nerdy to sporty. And we have Anthony Teixeira with us. What's happening today on the Sports Hub?
I mean, first off, I am both nerdy and sporty, so perfect man to like transition.
Yes.
Yeah. Definitely. Today on the Sports Hub, we are going to talk about everything that took place this past weekend. Arsene Wenger says goodbye to the Emirates. It was heartbreaking. And then at the same time, it was about time. Of course, then we talk about Super Rugby. Wow, the Jaguars. I cannot believe they actually did it. They defeated the Crusaders. And it's a bittersweet show.
Oh, no.
Michael Pedro and Ahmed Kaji, it's their final show tonight. I'm actually quite emotional.
I can see it.
Yeah, man. So the Unholy Trinity will be departing VAW FM. Well, two-thirds of them at least. I'll be remaining.
Okay.
Yeah.
At least we'll still have you.
Thanks for sounding so happy that I'm remaining. It's if only it was Michael Pedro.
Hey, I'm sharing in your sadness. We could end the show with a moment of silence, but that doesn't really work on radio because then people would just switch off their radios.
The other thing is that we are pretty much the loudest people at VAW.
That
and it would
true.
Be counterproductive to have a moment of silence. Awesome. Maybe we should just scream into the mic.
Oh, a moment of screaming. That
Why
could be
not?
A new thing. That could be a new thing. That's what's happening on the Sports Hub right after this on VAW FM. But this has been the Science Inside, and today has been all kinds of things from plastic bags to burn injuries. And I do want to leave you with a parting thought. That even though today's story I know might have felt like you almost don't want to think about it, I know a lot of us feel like that about burn injuries, take this Burns Awareness Month and just maybe look around your home, think about whether you know what to do if you did get burned. Do you know what to do if a child or a friend gets burned? Do you have maybe some products on hand or just the knowledge to be able to deal with these accidents when they happen so that you can make the best of it. A thank you goes out to all of our guests featured on the show today, including Dr. Suraka Muniasamy, Hulani Mabaza, and Dr. Wang Tankis. Our team behind the scenes is production by Bridget Lepere and Take Back Your Clan Nosehame, as well as our whole team of producers. The podcast is on Vits. Let me start that again. The podcast is wits.journalism.co.za/science. So do note that that has changed. I'm so used to the old address. It's now wits.journalism.co.za/science. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter as VowFM. Just make sure you use that hashtag Science Inside. My name is Elna Schutz, and this has been The Science Inside, which is produced by the Wits Radio Academy, funded in part by the South African Department of Science and Technology. Join us again next week.
The Science Inside, Monday from 6 to 7 p.m. on Power FM 88.1. The Science Inside Podcast.